To see examples of what we talked about on the show, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Random conversations that I have off camera.
No, they've been erased. They've been erased.
No, like literally, that's not a joke.
What is vaping?
It's vaping.
Oh, it's a vaping thing.
I'm trying to actually quit smoking, so
that's his silver crack pipe.
Yeah, this is my silver crack pipe, or my silver penis, as people call it.
No, I just ran out earlier today.
My silver penis. Quite well.
It's helped out a lot, and I still have a pack of cigarettes, but it's just kind of there as like a safety, and whenever I start getting. Because it's still that mentality. I've been smoking since I was 11. So it's like kind of ingrained into me. So this is just one thing to try to get me to finally quit.
I got you. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction.
As you can tell from that opening sequence.
Yep.
I'm your host, Dallas Busha, and this is episode number 114. We have another roundtable group today, and with me we have...
Don.
It's Rook.
Hash Browns again.
Desmond.
Out.
And out. Dallas.
Wow, congratulations on hitting puberty, Dallas.
So, hope everyone's doing good today. It's nice to see everyone back. Everyone back at our hidden fortress in Rook's house. So today we've got a special episode where we're going to start off with a couple of comics we're going to talk about, but then we're going to get into a fairly in-depth discussion about Lock and Key. A book by Joe Hill and, oh my god, what's the name
really?
Of the artist?
Gabriel Rodriguez. Damn. Right. You really did forget crap, didn't you?
Yeah.
It's only been a week.
So how is everybody? Anything new happened since the last time we talked?
No.
Apparently Billy blew some people.
In a row! And I was told that I was good.
They lied.
So, as usual, we've all been reading a lot of books, and so I figured let's go around, let's jump right into it because we got a lot to talk about today. Let's jump into it, and everybody grab maybe one book, and we'll have a quick discussion about it. And then after the music break, we're gonna jump into Lock and Key. All
right.
Who would like to begin?
I do.
Aw, Don.
Good for you,
gentlemen. First.
I noticed you guys need to put some hair on your chest.
What?
This is absolutely one of my very favorite comic series. It's Valerian and Loreline from France. It's by Pierre Christian and J.C. Mazières. These things, they've been printed in France since the early 60s. He's a space temporal pilot. Loreline he found in the 14th century France, which was in the first book, which they've never reprinted. But she came back in the future. They trained her. And now she's his partner. But in 1982, Dargaud Got America was printing these books. They printed four volumes. And this one is Heroes of the Equinox. Absolutely one of my favorite books. It's basically a contest on a planet. Everybody's really old. And they have a contest of champions. They had four different people. Valerian was one. One's from a warlike planet. The guy looks like a god of thunder, like a Norse gods. Another one is like almost like a Soviet Union planet. The guy has chains, he's, all machine-like. The third guy, it looks like a Hindu planet. Everything's plants and, growing with the land. Well, they're supposed to go through all these trials, and whoever wins gets to repopulate the planet with the goddess. And I really enjoyed this, and then I've read later that they said that I guess it was kind of a take on American comics. It was all kind of over the top and Jack Kirby-like. And I thought, well, that's why I liked it. I'm American, and that's the kind of comics I like. But it was really neat how they told the story, because they told it from the four different viewpoints. And that one, whenever I think of Valerian, I think of this. And this Sin Books just re-released this. This is, I think, the eighth or ninth book they've put out. They put out two every year. And now they finally put out all four books I already have. So now it's all open territory. Nevertheless, the architecture, the layout, the character design, It's right up there. If you're not reading Valerian, why aren't you? Get on it. You heard the dog.
Yeah, fight you all the way. So,
this one's okay. 78.
Yeah, that one's from 78.
Now, they're not in print anymore.
No, they are.
Oh, they are.
It's an English company called Sin Books that's putting them out. And Dargold, they didn't do them in order. They printed out, this was the third one Dargold put out. But they were just, you know, taking different, I guess some of the better issues.
Oh, because, yeah, this has number 8 on it.
Yeah.
So they're just...
But Sin Books, they started doing these a few years ago, and they put up to a year, and 4 of them I've never read. And then, you know, 4 of them are the ones Dargold put out in the early 80s.
You let me borrow one probably a year or so ago, and it was incredibly good.
That was Ambassador of the Shadows. That was the first one they released.
It was really fun.
And so where are you picking this up at? Where are you buying these at?
Online sellers.
Online?
Okay. Originally, in the 80s, I got them at comic shops. Now, unfortunately, I haven't seen them in any comic shop.
Yeah, no, of course not.
But you can get them through Sin Books website or, you know, Amazon or any of these places. I'm sure In Stock Trades or any of those that have them.
Nice.
But J.C. Mezier's and Mobius for the two production designers on The Fifth Element. And a lot of the stuff in Valerian they picked up for Star Wars. The Katina scene was in Valerian.
Really?
And, yeah. And Lucas, I mean, Lucas was a big comic book fan.
And he was a big, big Valerian fan. Mm-hmm. They say the Millennium Falcon was taken from Valerian spaceship. But, you know, it's different enough.
Yeah, well, the thing I liked about the one that I read is they're very dense. And I can see, I don't know if that's a hallmark of a lot of French comics, but it reminded me of some of Morbius' work, like The Ink and like Blueberry, to where there's a lot going on. I mean, this is only one, maybe a 48-page comic book, and every single page is packed with, like, exposition and different scenes. And, I mean, a lot of stuff going on. I like it.
Yeah, it's absolutely my favorite series. I'm actually kind of frightened that it's going to collapse before they print all the stuff in English. I've got some of the volumes in French. Unfortunately, it's a language that I can't read.
Is he still working today?
Yes, he's still working.
Oh, goodness.
Which is awesome.
Anybody got anything else? Well, Hash Browns and Dez have their noses in books.
And no, I have a prediction already, though, because I finally am able to read the female Thor. And my prediction, it's Freya. The female Thor.
That's an interesting prediction.
That's the mother? That's Thor's mother?
Mm-hmm.
Stepmother, technically.
Why are you saying that?
Well, hold on. Let me flip back here.
That was good, Rook. You're right. It was a stepmother.
Yes.
Right. In your face, Doug.
I didn't even think of that.
I don't know what page this is, but, you know, Odin's all ticked off and whatever, and he's like, it's time for you to remember your place in this world, Freya. And she's just kind of hovering over the hammer, and she says, yes, perhaps it is. And I'm looking at the artist on how they drew the lips. Because the only telltale sign is the chin and the lips. And I'm sorry, they're identical.
Okay, I'm going to say this. They're wanting you to think that, because if it was Freya, they wouldn't have said it. They're trying to smokescreen you, and they're going to turn around and you go, oh my God, and I said that on the show, and you're going to look like a fool. You're going to look like a fool.
Oh, what if I'm right, though?
You won't be.
Okay.
I hope it is Freya. Current plan. And as soon as they hear this podcast, they're going to change
it. Yeah, that's right. Of course. Yeah, because Marvel listens to us.
Because other people besides us listen to us.
The people who do that book are one of the 8 people that listen to this show.
Yeah. We're the other 6 or 7. No, it's going to turn out to be a dude with really pouty lips.
And boobs.
And really massive boobs.
Yeah. So, no, I don't think they're really massive.
I want to hear about The Walking Dead.
You want to hear about The Walking Dead?
Yeah. People still talk about that, right?
About The Walking Dead.
Like,
the TV show or the books? Hold on, there's people walking and people dying. Dead. And, yep, there you go.
Thanks.
Is this post-Fallout War?
Not a whole lot going on action-wise in the current Walking Dead series right now. Got some interesting developments as far as Rick has finally given...
he's
still alive for one, but Rick has finally given Carl some room.
Cool.
And Carl has actually moved to one of the other townships.
Rickson?
The son.
How old is the son now in the comic?
In the comic books, he's probably like 14, 15, maybe. I'm not real sure. But so now Carl, instead of living with his father, he's living in a different township doing a blacksmithing apprenticeship.
sounds riveting.
Well,
it could be
some gripping shit.
There are some interesting things going on with Carl and some of his reactions to people and people's reactions to him. But more interestingly is the Whisperers.
And who are they?
Apparently someone got the bright idea to skin zombies and wear their flesh.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
In order to blend in and move about as they wish.
Oh, okay.
Boy,
that's a good idea.
And when they're amongst the... they can move inside the herds of zombies, they whisper. So, hence being called the Whisperers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's the comic.
That's in the comic. That's
the comic.
Yeah, show doesn't come back to like February.
Because I'm more interested in the new show.
February 8th,
give
February 8th or 9th is
one problem I've got with the show, I'll be honest, I've always thought this. I understand about, you know, when the whole infrastructure falls apart and everybody goes tribal. The problem in the show, though, with the exception of Rick's group, everybody is just scum of the earth. It's just they're short-term thinkers. They're just taking and destroying even each other. And
well,
it wouldn't be that way all the time. But from what you're telling the comic, I mean, it
well,
seems
actually,
like...
actually, you're going to probably be seeing in the new season a little bit different view of that.
Right.
You'll want to tune into the new season because you'll be seeing something a little bit different, I think.
Okay.
If my theory is correct where they're going with the new season, you'll see something a little different. But in truth, what they're trying to show is the breakdown of humanity. Rick and his group represent something. It's not just the fact that they're all, you know... No, they represent the last piece, the last shred of humanity.
Right.
Well,
and that it shows... What the show is doing is it's a metaphor for... the individual person. Rick and his group are the last shreds of humanity left in a person who's breaking down. And parts of the group lose it, at other times it doesn't. So, you know, they're that balancing act between the beast and the man.
Right.
Fighting against all these other chaotic forces outside of themselves. It's a metaphor for personal psychology. You're constantly... The group itself is constantly fighting amongst itself and with itself and against all these forces outside of it to try and decide which way it's going. Is it going to be the man or is it going to be the beast? That's why Rick's group is the only human group, the only civilized-esque group you've seen.
Right.
To date.
Well, I guess, like I said, though, I like what you just said, but it wouldn't be everybody going, you know, chasing.
Well, they're just
tail.
Focusing on a certain.
Right, no, but you'd think that they'd run into some group or
the individual.
Well, in a way, they have. At the end of last season, with the hospital. The hospital group was a civilized group. Perhaps they weren't exactly doing what you would consider civilized with the whole serf, concept. The bondage of, you know, the service of slavery concept, but it's still a civilized concept beyond something like, say, the cannibals at Terminus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we have a unique perspective, too, coming from, it's almost like we're in Rick's group, so we're seeing it in a different context. If we were in an outside group, for instance, if we were in the hospital and we were happy with what's going on there, and we ran into Rick's group, They can come off as vicious pricks. Yeah, exactly.
Perhaps if you were following the group of cannibals this whole time, their way of life would have seemed perfectly reasonable to you as well.
It's all about perspective.
So you're being shown one perspective of the concept. But
I probably
also
would have been in with the governor. I mean, to be completely honest,
I think you would have been the governor.
You know,
probably.
In truth, if you think about it, the governor's group was not uncivilized. The governor was uncivilized.
Yeah, he was a nasty little
He
man.
Created one of the best homegrown towns
that
we've seen yet, and everything ran well, and everybody was happy, and maybe oblivious to what was going on with the governor.
But in truth, the governor was nothing more than a representation of America in a whole. From the outside,
yeah.
You know, the people wandering the streets, everything looked fine. But in the truth, behind everything, the people in control were completely out of their minds.
Well,
much like the American government.
He couldn't do anything. He didn't know how to repair the RV that they were staying in. He couldn't do anything except... He knew how to take over and control people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was the only thing he could do.
Yeah.
He's a sociopath.
He used the skill set available to him to survive. Mm-hmm. And you will see a lot of people doing that. Eugene did that.
Yeah.
With
true.
His confession.
Yeah. Yeah. That just happened to be his skill set.
Think about it. Eugene is almost identical to the governor. Why? Because he used manipulation to survive. They were both pretty much unskilled in anything but
exactly.
the manipulation of people. What makes Eugene any less evil than the governor? If Eugene decided that he needed to kill to survive or manipulate people into killing others to survive, he would have done it. But what you see is Eugene could have become the governor. Instead, he held on to his humanity.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm trying to explain that Rick's group in a whole is a representation of humanity, showing you that there is this balance, there is this struggle between, you know, which path are we going to go down. And Rick's group has not always made the choice of humanity. Sometimes they've chosen the beast, but for overall, they're the most human that they can be.
I'm looking more forward to seeing the new show because I want to see if I can get an origin story out of them in some form or another. What happened?
Oh, the new series that's coming out? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea. I haven't really paid any damn attention to any of that crap.
I think it's going to set on another area and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So hopefully you'll be able to see more.
Well, the new show? About the spin-off?
Yeah, the spin-off.
Yeah.
What's the spin-off supposed to be?
It's of The Walking Dead. I think it's more of like what happened.
Like how it started?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, basically what I think it's doing is they're taking... Because they did a bunch of webisodes, which were a whole separate storyline.
I never knew about
never
it.
Knew
yeah,
that,
yeah, online they did a whole separate storyline on webisodes, and none of it tied into the actual... Well, no, I'm sorry. Some of it did tie into the actual show. But they were just able to prove the fact that, you know, they could do a spinoff with those webisodes. So that's why they're making a spinoff.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether it's going to be like... They're going to do like if it was a biological... thing or you know
who knows. We'll have to wait and find out. I really don't know what the heck they're going to do, what the story or what the concept at all is going to be with any of that. So
do you like the idea that Rick is becoming like Shane? Like remember how Rick in the beginning he was like an officer of the law trying to he didn't really shoot first, but now he's like shooting people. It seems like whoever comes across didn't really follow his way. That's how Shane used to be. And I don't know if you can ever do you see the character being involved, right?
Guy.
And then
yeah.
And his son is becoming like Rick, kind of like, you know, giving kind of like philosophical like advice to, because he was talking like that to I forgot the girl with the samurai sword. I forgot her name.
Michonne.
Yeah.
Well, Carl's had a strange life himself because. The majority of his life now has been living in this kind of apocalypse, you know? And so he's kind of learned responsibility, he's learned values from that perspective. So it's very strange. Although most of that he's getting from Rick, he's also getting it from other sources, mostly in the group.
You know, the question here is really, is Rick becoming more like Shane?
Right.
Or is what's happening to Rick a reflection of the world around him? He's living in an extremely brutal world. Shane became brutal before the world became
yeah.
brutal.
Okay. That's how I feel.
And so I don't see Rick's character as a reflection of Shane. I see Rick's character as a reflection of the world around him, where Shane was ready to do brutal, horrific things to people
in order to survive, right?
Just because they crossed his path. Just because you were standing there, Shane was ready to do something horrific. Where Rick will wait and see what you do first.
Well, Rick has fought it. I mean, even when the Terminus thing goes on, he kept saying, I can't let the monster out. Mm-hmm. He's doing it for the better of everybody. You know, I mean, he's trying to, you know, straighten things out. Shane was just nuts. And he was just getting more and more nuts and aggravated as it went on. But he was thinking of him and him only. Rick is thinking of everyone and the benefit of the group. Okay. I understand about he's getting rough and wild. But
yeah.
But you could trust Rick. Shane was a wild card that made no sense.
Yeah. Yeah, wild card's right.
Yeah, he really was, because, I mean, you just never know. I mean, he could have turned around and shot somebody just simply because, in his paranoid delusion, he felt that this person was getting ready to betray him. So he could have turned around and shot somebody for any good for no good reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You
where Rick is a reactionary. Rick will react to what you do to the group. Not just to him, but to the group as a whole. He reacts. So
yeah, it was kind of weird because, like, the latest one I saw when Rick, he actually shot a security guard. One of the guys.
One of the other cops.
Right. It's right. Like, you don't really, I don't know, would you shoot your own, he's not like a fellow person that he knows, but it's like, you know, there's like some kind of code. Like, I'm a cop, you're a cop, would you do the same thing, you know?
But, see, the difference there is that Rick's concept of the duties and need and what the responsibilities of being an officer of the law are were very different than theirs.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know? Rick has this concept to him that because I am an officer of the law, I am to protect people.
Yeah, you're responsible for their safety.
Okay. I'm responsible for them to be safe. Where the hospital staff, police officers, they were more of a concept of, I'm an officer of the law, therefore I am entitled to do what I want.
Yeah, there's a difference right there.
You know, so what you're seeing is the difference between, you know, good cop, bad cop.
Okay.
You know.
The only thing I can say, if you're watching The Walking Dead and you're having trouble, we're going to post Rook's phone number. So if you're watching and confused, feel free to call that number and Rook will walk you through and explain everything.
I don't know about my number, but you can always find me on Twitter if you're looking to have an interesting conversation about Walking Dead. I'm always more than happy. It's at I am the unsung. Hit me up. Let's talk.
Cool. Desmond, you're reading a book over there. What do you got?
Oh, I'm just in the middle of it. Like a book on how to be happy by Eleanor Davis.
Yeah. No, Donna mentioned this before.
Yeah, Al and I talked about it on the show, but Al wouldn't read it. He said it looked nice and stuff. I found this Facebook. I like Fantagraphic books. And Fantagraphics is posting pictures, and I kind of liked them. And I thought, okay, and that was all as far as it was. It was one of those books where I thought, that'd be kind of neat to see. But every once in a while, they post some more pages, and I finally thought, I want to get this. So I bought it. I thought, you know, it's all by Eleanor Davis, stories and artwork. And it's an anthology, basically, by one person. She kind of works in different styles and techniques. And I thought I would just take a long time to read it. And I read the whole thing in one sitting. And it's turned into one of my absolute favorite books. I feel everybody should have this in their collection. Des had seen it at work one time when I was lending it to Dallas. He thought it was a cookbook. like I said, it's strong work. I've never heard of Eleanor Davis before. She does a lot of magazine work. I follow her on Facebook now, and she's always posting stuff. She's pretty prolific. But she's a great artist, and her stories are neat. And one thing I had said to Al, she doesn't over-explain the stories. You're kind of seeing snippets of these different worlds, and it's enough. But it kind of leaves it open for your own mind and interpretation, which
yeah.
I like, but it's hard to do. Some artists that become writers over-explain everything and take away your imagination. A good writer can tell you enough, but also leave it up to your own mind to where you can build on it. And that's what she does. And sometimes she's got kind of almost lyrics to songs or poetry. I think it's one of the most outstanding books I've ever read.
Yeah, you let me borrow it. And same thing here. I ran through it in one sitting. I mean, I just blazed through it, and I really loved it. It's very, for the most part, her art is very minimalist. And not all of it, though. Actually, the specific one Desmond's looking at right now works with a lot of darks and shades. Reminds me of the Hernandez brothers. But it is very, not only is her art, for the most part, minimal, but so is the story. and in a good way. She'll take a specific or a germ of an idea or a philosophy and just kind of run with it through a story. And the majority of it's pretty existential. And it's never the same concept. I mean, there's stuff about relationships, about society, like a small group of people trying to create a society on a microcosm, kind of what we were just talking about with The Walking Dead. Yeah. There's a great one. There's a girl. She lives outside of the city in a small enclosed area where it's an area full of farmers, and they raise organic food and vegetation, and she goes into the city, which is covered in smog, and it's almost like a science fiction story. The people that live in the city have to wear a suit so they don't breathe in the air. And so it's a very dualistic story, and it's really neat in this execution, though, because it's just so minimal, just bare bones and poetic.
That was my favorite story of the whole book. Yeah. I mean, there was other ones I liked, but that one, she showed you enough, and you saw both sides of it. And that was the thing. When that woman came back to her old city and the old life, it was so unhealthy, and they were looking at how she lived in the dome as, you know, paradise, and she was so fortunate. She yeah. saw that, but at the same time, as she's getting used to being back at home, she told her sister, "I'm thinking of coming back." And she was talking about the things she missed, which is absolutely how it would be in real life. But she didn't explain about what happened. Well, she didn't really need to. She kind of showed you what happened to the society. And, you know, it's basically finances. This is why they haven't been able to go back to the old way like it was in the dome. But that was the one to me that stood out. But
what I like about her style of storytelling, too, is analyzation doesn't necessarily have to equate to explanation. Yeah. So she's telling more by saying less. And I think she pulls it off really, really well in those stories.
Yeah, like, one of my favorite short stories is, like, it's like only like two pages, basically. It's like this woman and this sculptor is like chiseling out some, like, this statue, and she's feeding him some ideas. And eventually what it is at the end of the panel, like the two panels, is a person of herself. So it's like, yeah, they have very different, like, messages that they give.
You're right. And so, yeah, if you're into you know, something like that, I think all of us would suggest this book. It's called How to Be Happy by Eleanor Davis, and it's profound without being pretentious. That's what I like.
I read Mad Magazine and Archie Comics.
Well, they make you pretty happy. So.
They make me happy.
That's right.
That storyline, you said, not making me happy.
She even says at the beginning that, you know, the book isn't really a book about how to
make
you happy.
It's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah. But have you gotten to the Skin and the Fox story, the little poem?
No. Is it the one that they, it's the boatman that ferries the people?
No.
Okay, then I didn't
get
the
that one. Was good too.
Yeah, that was good.
Oh, it was all good.
Where'd you pick this up at?
I didn't. I couldn't find it anywhere. I kept seeing it on Facebook on Fantagraphics thing. So I just ordered it on an online seller. I've never seen it in any store.
Yeah, it's Fantagraphics,
yeah.
You said? That's right.
I think it's, you might check.
It looks like a Fantagraphics book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's FB.
FB, yeah, okay.
It's, again, it's outstanding. I guarantee you, if you start looking at it, and I've read it, you know, more than once. I pull it out and look through things. I love her art style.
It changes, and, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the first story, I really liked. The one where everybody's Adam and Eve. You know, that wasn't what I thought when I'm starting to read it.
All right. Put a bookmark in so you can pass it around.
Okay.
Wait. Here, hand it to me. Just take a...
Here. You know.
Never mind, we got one right there.
One of
those. I just don't want Des to lose his page because he's reading it.
Oh, yeah.
But if anybody wants to thumb through it.
Well, see, now Des won't be able to read it in one setting.
All right, guys, on that note, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and we're going to talk some more comics.
can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
But anyway, I took it out of the tags after you told me that.
Yeah, so don't ever mention Barry Buttface. No,
I've never actually looked at how many views I've gotten on YouTube.
Well, you have also never looked at our blog.
Is it more than 1,000?
No,
it's 27.
Well, it's 27 on one.
Did you find the icon?
Yeah, I did. I clicked over, and that's how I ended up on my YouTube channel.
Bring us back in, Donnie.
Go on YouTube and look up the creature feature with Doc and Clown.
Wait. All right, bring us in.
Okay, that was Sumeria. This is the last song we have. They're banned in Manila. That is fantastic. I wish I was there to see them.
They were banned in Manila?
No, they're a band in Manila. They're really tight. I enjoy them. I enjoy hearing my wife singing their songs to herself as she walks through the house. If you have a chance to see them, go see them, hire them, do whatever you can. Keep this band in work, and that's the last song we got. Please make some more. Bye.
End of plug.
Click. All right, before the music break, actually at the beginning of the show, we teased Lock and Key. And I know for one that I'm super excited to talk about it.
Sorry, hit the wrong button.
That's an emergency broadcast system.
Wrong button.
So we've
bad touch.
There's this little comic book called Lock and Key by Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. Perhaps you've heard of it. It's only one of the very best comic books to come out in the past 10 years. And jeez, it's broken up into 6 volumes. Don and I have read the first 5 volumes, and Rook's read all of them, so Rook, no spoilers on volume 6.
You don't want to know how it ends?
You can spoil it if you want.
Come on! No, dude, I don't want to know. Well, alright, you have 5 minutes to read this, and then we'll continue.
Go, guys, go.
Go.
One thing I lock and key, Dallas told me about this book, and I read the 4th volume, and I did like it, but I didn't love it. And as they were talking about another episode, you know, Rook had mentioned you have to read these in order, you know, for it to make any sense. Because I couldn't quite understand. That's the last episode we're talking about the Fantastic Four. I've read parts of these, you know, issue after issue once in a while, but I've never read the whole thing. And most of those books I've read out of order. I mean, I've read stuff from, you know, the early 60s to the late 60s. And, it always made sense. Before, with any comic, you could pick one up and read it, and then if you liked, you could go get the back issues. It all made sense. I will say, reading these from 4 all the way, or 1 all the way up to 5, if you don't read these books in order, you're screwed.
Yeah, no, these are definitely not standalone stories.
Yeah, and it's a completely different reading experience. When I said before, 4 I read, but I kind of forgot parts. When I read these, I read 4 again in order, and it was like reading a brand new book. It's a fantastic series that I recommend. When I just read the 1 book, I wouldn't have said that.
Is every volume a complete story, or do you have to read five or six of them to get the...
What it is these were all singular issues, of course. Okay,
yeah.
So it wasn't originally just graphics. Each one of these is basically a
mini series.
An arc. Yeah, a story arc in the line.
I got you.
Okay, so each one of the graphics is unto itself its own story, its own piece. So everything starts with Welcome to Lovecraft, the first one. So to jump into the 4th one, you know,
you're missing a lot of exposition.
Yeah, you're missing a whole hell of a lot.
But each book doesn't finish. It's not like into book 1. I mean, they all blend right into the next one.
Yeah, and they all pick up where the last one left off.
Oh, okay. So, right. But at the very end, it ends the storyline.
It ends that storyline, the particular Welcome to Lovecraft, Head Games, Crown of Shadows, they end when they end. But it picks up right afterwards with the next storyline, like Keys,
but that's the
kingdom.
End of the series, is what I'm saying. At the very
the Alpha Omega is the very end.
Okay.
The single most impressive aspect of this entire run, to me, has been the writer Joe Hill's
pacing.
Stephen King's son.
Yes, he is. He's
his. What am I looking for? His the amount of planning ahead he does and the foreshadowing he does. he has everything completely planned out from the first book, and you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there will be a lot of callbacks. You'll see something occur in book two that you'll kind of glaze over because you're not really sure what it means, or it's just part of something else.
Yeah.
You won't find out about it until book four, but then it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
I mean, everything's been planned out
well,
to a T.
Keyhouse. Keyhouse itself means nothing in the first book for a while. You don't understand it. And they run past certain objects or certain rooms in the house, and you don't notice it. And then when the fourth or fifth book, they focus on that particular room or particular object, you realize, wait a minute, I've been seeing this grandfather clock the entire goddamn series.
Yes,
and there will be specific scenes, for instance, like maybe a Tarantino movie, or if you've seen, like, There Will Be Blood, or one of those kind of movies that'll have a scene that they'll revisit later, but they'll expound upon it. And then you'll be like, oh, you know, when I read that scene back in book one, it made sense then, but now seeing it again and seeing what happened directly before that scene makes 10 times more. It makes much more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So it's nice jumping back and forth between time, too, because it does jump back and forth between a lot of timelines, because it's basically the story of a father and his children. And this is not really a spoiler, but in the very beginning of the book, the father's murdered.
Yeah. I mean, this happens within the first few pages.
Yes.
So this is the setup of the entire thing.
The main storyline follows his three children. However, the story constantly
goes
back in time.
His three children and his wife and his brother.
Right.
So everything basically breaks down to they move back to the father's childhood home, Keyhouse, in Lovecraft, Massachusetts. I think it is Massachusetts, right? Yeah. It's New England. So so they all move back into, you know, their father's childhood home and discover that their father's childhood was very different than what they knew their father to be.
Yeah.
So,
and there's a lot of flashbacks of bits and parts of their father's childhood, but then you won't...
Yeah, they start to discover things about their dad that they just, you know, they never knew their father, is basically what they're finding out. And they had no concept that their father was, you know, this person that, you know, all the oldest son ever saw the father as was the school guidance counselor.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what he was. And that's all he ever was. You know, he didn't realize that his father was, you know, what his father was and what he had been through to shape the man into what he is or was.
Sounds like a movie.
Yeah,
I think there were going to be a movie like that.
Actually, it was going to be a television series.
God, I hope so.
Yeah. You hope so. It failed. they did the pilot, apparently. And I think it was for Fox. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. But at any rate, the network decided, no, we're not going to pick that up. And I forget what crappy shows they picked up that they canceled within the first, like, 12 episodes.
No.
So now, apparently, it's being optioned for a movie. Because Joe Hill wrote Horns, which everybody knows. Daniel Radcliffe starred in the movie Horns. Phenomenal movie. Great book. I found the book, the movie to actually be fairly close enough to the book that I found it acceptable. And still freaking cried like a baby during the scene with the letter. If you've seen the movie or read the book, you know what I'm talking about. So, you know, Joe Hill's he's not new to the idea of Hollywood and his stuff being turned into a movie.
And especially if this movie, if now that Horns has been successful, they're going to dig back
and
find something. And
they're talking about this not just being a one-off, they're talking about it possibly being a trilogy or more. So
that would be awesome. And the cool thing, we were talking about how the children are discovering things about their father in Lock and Key, and the reader is finding these things out along with the children.
Yeah.
That's
so it's a mystery / horror.
That's something I really enjoyed on that was, like Rook was talking about the father. It's interesting to see how it all starts unfolding and who he is. Also his brother, you know, his childhood, and all the other characters to it. And I didn't see any of these things coming. I mean, sometimes some writers, and I'm talking comic books, well, you know, even prose writing, sometimes you're already starting to see where they're going with it. But that's what they want you to see. You know, like you start foreshadowing things, So you're already kind of figuring out as you go on. And sometimes they're just bad writers and you figure it out right away.
Or they're just very formulaic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This one right here, I didn't quite... You didn't understand what was going on. The clues are right there in front of you. And then all of a sudden...
The clues are in front of you, but they're not pointed out to you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All the pieces of the puzzle are there. But you don't know that they exist.
Because there's no emphasis put on them. Yeah. They're subtle.
Yeah. It's almost like he shows you the entire story in the first story. He tells you everything in Welcome to Lovecraft, but he doesn't explain it until you get into Head Games, Crown of Shadows, Keys to the Kingdom, Clockworks.
Clockworks pretty much explains it all.
Clockworks pretty much explains everything. Clockworks is where he's drawn you in and built everything here for you. And you're sitting there going, oh my god, I've got all this information. How does it all tie together? And in Clockworks, he sits down and goes, okay, here's how everything works, how everything actually ties together. Yep. And that's why I think it's brilliant that, it's revolved around the grandfather clock. The story arc is called Clockworks.
Well, you had touched on this a minute ago, but there's keys. In this house, there's numerous keys, and each key has magical abilities. Each key does something specific and unique. For instance, there's a key that'll open a door, and each key opens a different door into something. So for instance, one key that one of the children finds, the youngest child, opens a door, and when you walk through the door, you leave your body.
The key to
your
the
body just drops.
In Welcome to Lovecraft, the first key found is the key to the black door. And when you use the key to open the black door, it doesn't look like anything. But when you walk through the black door, your spirit leaves your body.
Yes.
So,
and there's just a number of keys that do these awesome things. There's a key that allows you to fly, gives you wings. I don't remember how that
well,
occurs.
There's some very different things later on. Just focusing on the keys themselves, like Head Games focuses around the head key, where you can unlock your head and actually remove memories, or you can implant things.
Which looks freaking awesome with Gabriel Rodriguez's art.
Oh, God. And the brilliant concept of that, when other people are looking into your head, somehow you're standing there next to them looking into your head, too.
Yeah. It's really neat looking.
Yeah, it's really quite...
And, the fifth volume we were just talking about, Clockworks, which pretty much explains the history of the Locke family, is there's a key to a grandfather clock. And when you open up this clock... When you set a time and date, you will go back in time.
Yeah, and it's not just it's not really the Locke family itself. It's Key House. It's the grandfather clock shows you everything about Key House.
Yeah, Key House is the mansion the family lives in, and it's basically a character in the book itself.
Yeah, the Key House is itself its own character as well.
And this is all from the Revolutionary War, right?
Things start around the Revolutionary War in the storyline and progress forward. The really interesting thing is in the back of some of the graphics are the little notations made by like the ancestors of the Locke children, where they talk about the creation of the keys and what the different keys do. And the fun one is when they show how like... The different keys were made at different points in time, different times in history. Here it is. So, like, you have the Omega key, which is burn, so you don't actually know what it does. The ghost keys, the echo key, gender key, the giant's key, the mending key. So there's all these different keys. So
yeah, when I read those are little cards, and more... different ones that show up in each issue. They just kept building.
Yep.
But I thought that was written by the creator of the key, because he was talking about his sister.
Right. Well, and these...
Some of
these,
them were written by different people, because different people made the keys.
Yeah, this series of keys was all made by the first key maker, the ancestor of the locks. The Omega key, the ghost key, the echo key, anywhere key, head key, gender key, shadow key, giant key, mending key. Then later on, you start to find out that there are other keys involved. Here we are. You get all these keys, and then you get into, like, you can see where the transition changes. Yeah. And you've got the animal key, the music box key, the skin key is a really interesting one, which really
isn't... The music box key is awesome, because it's like a tiny little... You'll open a little music box, and the music box will sing, and whatever words it's singing, anybody hearing it has to listen to it. So if it says for you to stop, you won't be able to move.
Yeah, it kind of sings this song about, you can't move, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, it's really
so
neat.
Yeah, and... Here's some of the other keys, like the ones with the angel wings that you were talking about and stuff.
Yep.
What's interesting on these keys, on the angel wing key and the Hercules key, the note cards are actually written in German.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice touch.
Yeah, that was a really, really nice touch. So, you know, you get to see that, you know, it's not always been the locks and that family that's been making these keys. There's been some other people involved through history. So.
Well, when I was reading that, though, as far as the keys, they seem so random in the story. And I kept thinking, why would you want that key? What was the purpose? And then when I read those, and the key maker was explaining why he made those, I thought, okay, that makes perfect sense. But in the modern times, you know, and that's what I liked, was how his brother in the past was using some of the keys and why.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay. But the roots to them, there was a reason for everything in there. It's a really strong story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the most amazing keys that they have in the whole story, personally, is probably the skin key. Because it's actually not a key. It's a mirror. Shaped like a key, you know. So, but, you know, to change your skin color. Here we go. Excerpts from the Journal of Harold Locke, 1851. So, you know, it actually tells you where these excerpts are from. Excerpts from the Diary of Haynes Rifle and Correspondence with Jean Locke, 1942. The Known Keys excerpts from the Diary of Benjamin Pierce Locke, 1757 through 1799.
Now, not giving too much away, but the Omega Key, which we don't really find too much out about until Book 5, I believe, is kind of a much desirable key, and the villain of the piece, named Dodge, is looking for that key.
Yeah, this entity, Dodge, is,
it's a demon from hell.
Well,
basically.
No, Dodge really isn't a demon. I mean, he's...
Well, I haven't read Book 6.
Okay, all right.
Well, one thing in that... I remember we did our favorite here, you know, our own super teams and stuff, and you had Dodge.
Yeah.
Now, when I read 4, I couldn't quite figure out what he was, because he was friends with him, and it seemed like he was, you know, against him, you know, stabbing him in the back. When I read the thing, from the beginning, he just seemed like a person of pure evil. But then in book, I guess it's 5, when they start, you know, explaining everything, he was a great guy. And then it has the one sequence of what happened.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really tell what that was. You know, when Dallas says demon from hell.
That's just me presuming that's what it is, because I haven't read the whole story.
Yeah, basically, what made Dodge special was gone. I don't know. It's
well, Dodge is the creature, and Lucas Caravaggio, or however you say it, was one of Papa Locke's friends. Whoever the father of the Locke
is. Yeah, the Locke father's friends.
Yeah, he was a good friend, and he ended up dying, and his body was taken over by this creature.
Yeah, that's...
Sure.
Yeah, that's
you guys haven't read 6 yet. I can't have this conversation. Come on.
So 6 explains a lot, then.
Apparently. Damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, 6 explains a lot of stuff, and like I said,
So the one thing, we've talked a lot about Joe Hill and how he's really good at pacing the story and how he's had everything planned out and how well he's developed the keys. But one thing I think he's really good at as well is dialogue.
The dialogue is absolutely fantastic, but one thing that I want to point out is just what an incredible artist Gabriel Rodriguez is. I mean... Gabriel Rodriguez, I mean, just the amount of detail that goes into some of this stuff that, you know, that they've done here is just absolute gorgeous. I mean,
it's beautiful. I totally agree.
You know, the house itself, the character of Dodge.
Have you seen anything? I saw it a while back ago.
Yeah, here.
But one thing about his artwork, He's a very tight artist.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's not just that, like the keys. Every key is unique and ornate and mm-hmm. functional.
Yeah.
And when Rook is talking about key house, it'd be easy to get lost in any of the stuff because it's all complex. But the way he draws it, even though it's a very detailed, very tight,
simplified you never, way.
Yeah, he's got a way of doing storytelling. I keep trying to imagine myself getting these scripts from Joe Hill, and just getting lost with it. When you read the story, the artwork and the story are just as complex together, and you never get lost, even though it's really a bizarre theme.
You're right. The world's fully realized. Each character, and more importantly, every single key feels like a personality. It's unique.
Yeah.
You see that key, it's immediately identifiable.
You see that key, you can immediately identify it. And you also see the fascinating things. Well, here, just take a look at this. All right, this is number 2, Head Games, right? Here's the grandfather clock. What's on top of the grandfather clock?
Yeah, they show it.
The clockwork
key.
What are
we looking at? There it is. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know,
you see
once
this
again,
key.
The detail
yes,
that these two...
And you don't see that again until book 5.
Well, and here's a fun little thing is... Here's the youngest lock wandering around with the head key, trying to figure out what the hell it goes to. And Rodriguez has got drawn onto it the little keyhole on the back of the kid's head the whole time.
Yeah.
And of course he can't see that.
I never noticed it until he unlocks his head. And I went back a few pages and I was like, holy crap.
That's what I
he
meant.
He really had this attention to detail in his artwork is fantastic.
And like you were saying, it's there, but you wouldn't know it unless you were looking for it. It's mm-hmm. very subtle.
That's also the writer, too. I'm sure the writer is brilliant.
Oh, absolutely. Under direction of
Joe
Hill.
It just shows communication between the writer and the artist.
Well, that's what I'm curious about is exactly how much, because again, with Watchmen, we all attest it to Alan Moore. I think basically you think of Alan Moore's Watchmen. But a lot of this stuff was Dave Gibbons. I mean, both of them worked together. But a lot of that stuff Dave Gibbons put in there came up with. And that's the thing here. I wonder, did Joe Casey spell every
Joe
single
Hill.
Thing? I keep saying Joe Casey. I really like Joe Casey. But Joe Hill, he wrote everything out. I'm just curious if he told him everything to put. How much of this was Gabriel Rodriguez besides just being a good artist and storyteller? Did he come up with some of these things?
No, I'm guessing that he might have.
Yeah, seeing Joe Hill's other work with like horns and stuff, he's a fantastic writer, very detailed. You know,
is that Joe Hill also in Gabriel Rodriguez?
Horns is just a novel. It's not a comic book. So, but Horns is fantastically detailed, but not to the point of excess. It's not like you're reading Anne Rice, who spends an entire goddamn chapter about how to land a plane, you know.
Or Tolkien, entire chapter explaining a hill.
Yeah, a rock.
But Tolkien is awesome when he does that.
And Tolkien can get off on these tangents in his writing where it's like, there was a rock, it had moss. Moss, much like the moss growing on the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, I mean... You know,
so you're pretty much describing anybody who listens to the show would like Tolkien.
But as far as Hill goes, I mean, he gets to very descriptive and very in-depth, but not to the point where you can't paint the picture yourself. I have a feeling that, you know, he wrote it, gave Rodriguez the information, and Rodriguez painted the picture himself, you know. That's just the impression I get from his other work.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a good series. I think we all recommend it.
Yeah.
Oh, but, highly. It's one of the best books I've read in years.
Yeah.
But start from the first one.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't give Don an idea.
And this whole thing is all the fault of Brittany over at Yancey Street Comics. This is her fault because she kept on me over and over again about Lock and Key over and over. And, you know... I think Dallas said something about Lock and Key, and I was like, yeah, I've heard of that. That's that book that I keep hearing about from Britt up at the comic book shop. And then I went into the comic book shop, and I'm wandering around, and I grabbed the first one, and she gave me this look, and said, I think she said something about time.
Thanks, Brittany.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Brittany. And Brittany's also one that recommended Rat Queens, too. So,
nice,
you know,
there you go.
You can pretty much take anything she recommends and go, all right, that's awesome.
Well, I give it the highest recommendation, though. Lock and Key, it's awesome. And Dez, are you on the last
Dez
page?
Is done.
I'm done.
Dez,
oh my god.
Dez just
done.
Finished reading How to Be Happy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you feel happy?
I feel happy.
He's smiling. He's smiling.
That's right. Thanks, Don, for the book. Let me read
it. You're welcome. Now, my question is on the Fox story. What did you think of that?
Oh, I don't know. It's kind of... I couldn't describe it. It's just kind of weird having to, just, you know, skinning the fox down and...
Because Al was freaking out. He was thumbing through on the sugar. This is freaky. This is freaky. He just kept carrying on.
It reminded me of... have you read From Hell?
Yeah,
there was an entire sequence where the doctor, I can't remember his name, is skinning one of the prostitutes. And it's like 10 pages of graphic Eddie Campbell detail cutting up her skin and...
But have any of you guys ever skinned an animal?
Nope.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have too. We used to be able to sell rabbit pellets. We'd go hunt rabbits, you know, eat them. And we'd, you know, cut the pellets off, and you could get a dollar and a quarter for them when I was a kid. And, I don't know. I didn't find it weird.
But is it supposed to show emotions that... I don't understand how is that supposed to evoke happiness or... The idea, like skinning a fox.
No, it's ironic.
Oh, is that supposed to, okay? Oh,
well, the whole point of the book, she said at the beginning, this book isn't really to tell you how to be happy.
Uh-huh.
But she says making it made her happy.
Oh, you mean the author happy, right?
Yeah.
So if
okay.
you find meaning in something,
this is horrible.
That will make you happy.
Well, Al, you eat meat. Do you ever think of where
it
comes from?
Yeah.
It comes from like little round pieces.
Yeah, like in Publix,
yeah,
you
see,
just go buy it.
I think when you're
round pieces.
Ash Brown, set up a hunting trip. We're bringing Al with us.
No.
All right.
And no, it's because you know you have to skin the animal.
Yeah, I know, but I mean,
now,
you know.
skinning human beings is different. That's gross.
Yeah,
it's not.
I think
that much different.
I only can think of a Hellraiser.
All of a sudden.
Yeah.
Where did he come from?
It's not that different.
The same concepts.
All right, guys. On that note, we're going to take off for the episode. Thank you, everyone, for sticking around and listening to us. Hopefully, if you have not picked up any of the books we talked about, you will now. You can find them at any of your local comic shops, or you can probably buy them online. But go to a local comic shop. Support them. All right, thanks for listening, and everybody at the round table, thank you for hanging out with me.
It's actually a square table.
It's a square. Don't give away the illusion.
But
right.
Go around it. Go around it.
We can do all right.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, until next time, take care of yourself. And
read more comics.
To find Al's other podcasts, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and click on the Cyclops!